We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. The mankind's future on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio, February 7, 2016. After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. Super Bowl Sunday here today. What'd you think of the game? I don't have much to think about it. Not a big sports fan, but it's a big game of the year, so hopefully everybody enjoyed that. We got a doubleheader here tonight on the program. We're going to be followed immediately, as always, by the Carl Stern Dragon King Dark Show. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But first, on tonight's program, we will be talking UFOs. Scott and Suzanne Ramsey are our guests here today. They're going to be talking the Aztec UFO incident. This from Amazon.com. The Aztec incident, the first ever widely publicized report of a recovered flying saucer, was derided as a hoax for decades. But now the Ramseys and Frank Thayer reveal the exact spot where the craft landed and show how the 100-foot diameter saucer was moved to a secret laboratory. Witnesses to the incident, who were interviewed by the authors, affirm that they were sworn to secrecy by the military. The authors also reveal the names of scientists who worked on the craft after its recovery. Also included are previously unseen documents from the CIA, FBI, U.S. Air Force, and U.S. Army that constituted a cover-up whose sole purpose was to surround the Aztec story with a smokescreen of lies, misinformation, and destructive allegations. Roswell is no longer the only proven flying saucer recovery we know about. The Aztec UFO incident is a must-read for historians and UFO students alike. The Aztec UFO incident available at Amazon.com and a number of other places as well. And if you are listening live here tonight, during the interview, we're going to give you the opportunity to get an autographed copy and maybe a special surprise as well if you are one of the first people to order. So that's coming up later on here tonight. Have you heard of the Aztec incident? I'm sure most people have heard of Roswell, but as we will be talking about on the show here tonight, the Roswell story originally was a one and done. And then later, the story took on a life of its own in the 90s. But originally, as noted, it was a one-day story. The Aztec UFO incident was actually a story that had legs for years before it was, I shouldn't say discovered to be a hoax, until people decided this must be a hoax. And we're going to talk about here why it was originally derided, as it says here, as a hoax. This from Wikipedia. The 1948 Aztec New Mexico UFO incident, sometimes known as the Other Roswell, was a hoaxed flying saucer crash and the subject of the 1950 book Behind the Flying Saucers by Frank Scully, which was a very famous book at the time. In early March 1948, an unidentified aerial craft was reported hovering over Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Approximately 2 weeks later, on March 25, 1948, in Hart Canyon, a similar UFO was said to have made a controlled landing after being shot at by the military. Supposed witnesses claim that 16 dead humanoid figures were found near the craft, and that the craft itself was said to be 99 feet in diameter, the largest UFO to date. The craft was alleged to be made of a material impervious to all heat. Every account noted a hole in the craft's portal and described the humanoid figures as childlike in size. Other reports were more detailed, describing the creatures as between 36 inches and 42 inches in height, weighed around 40 pounds. It was alleged that shortly after the craft was down, the military cleared the area of evidence, including the bodies, subsequently taking it to Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Indeed, the belief at Hangar 18, which is said to house every downed UFO captured in the U.S., was spawned by the Aztec incident. The incident gave birth to the Aztec UFO Symposium, which was run by the local library as a fundraiser from 1997 until 2011. Notable people who have come forward as witnesses include NASA engineer Bob Oshler and Fred Reed, an employee of the Office of Strategic Services. Now, as noted, there was belief in the 50s that this ended up being a hoax. It says here that Silas Newton and Leo Gebauer, had traveled through Aztec attempting to sell devices known in the oil business as doodle bugs. They claimed that the devices could find oil, gas, and gold, and that they could do so because they were based on alien technology. To substantiate their claim, they reported the UFO crash to Frank Scully for Variety. At the time the article was published, nobody else had come forward as a witness. When J.P. Kahn of the San Francisco Chronicle asked the Kahn men for a sample of the alien technology, they provided him with a sample, which turned out to be aluminum. 4 years later, the hoax was exposed in True magazine. After the article was published, many victims of the pair came forward. One of the victims was the millionaire Herman Glader, who pressed charges. The two were convicted of fraud in 1953. It says here that William Steinman and Wendell Stevens later wrote a book about the incident entitled UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret, which was published in 1986. In 2011's The Aztec Incident, our guest today, Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, combined their own research, 30 years of research, by the way, and $500,000 spent, with newer witness testimony, and argued that the crash, or more accurately, an uncontrolled landing with minimal damage, may indeed have occurred more or less as originally described by Scully. So they believe this is not only not a hoax, but that Scully may have got it right when he wrote that book in the 1950s. Our guest tonight will be Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. We'll be joined by them here in a few minutes. Want to mention, it is a doubleheader tonight. The new Carl Stern show is going to be following this one for those of you listening live. You'll be able to grab it later on at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, which is our website. On this week's episode, Carl Stern is going to deal with the question, what does this all mean anyway? He says here, just what is information and how do you make use of it? While you might at first glance think this episode has little to do with science, horror, the paranormal, or, well, anything After Dark related, it is actually a very basic to understanding what do we do with what we know and what do we not know and how to make use of that information. You'll be able to hear Carl Stern's show immediately following After Dark Radio here tonight on the Dark Matter Digital Network. And if you missed that show or any portion of this one, or you just want a copy, you'll be able to head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com and grab the MP3s. We also have a new column up right now at the website by Mark Howes. He has written a number of columns for us. The newest one is about the Shroud of Turin. I'm sure most of you have heard of the Shroud of Turin. I'm going to read the opening portion of this, and if you want more, you can head up to the website and read the whole thing. Mark Howes writes, there is a 14-foot by 4-foot piece of linen depicting a full-sized image of a bloke He's from the UK, by the way, Mark Howes. Around 6 feet tall, big old beard, and weighing around 180 pounds. The cloth is linen. It has a specific 3-to-1 twill weave, similar to fabrics from 1st century Palestine, and not generally found in medieval Europe, and is said to contain pollen fossils from plants that grew only in Palestine at the same time. Weird thing is, the image on the shroud is said to be Jesus. Yes, old JC himself. Many Christians believe that it is the actual cloth used to wrap Jesus' body after his crucifixion, and the image is a miraculous picture of the face and body of Jesus. It first turned up in the history books in 1353, and its whereabouts, if there are any before that, are still debated to this day. Author Ian Wilson has proposed that the shroud was the image of Edessa, but scholars such as Avril Cameron have stated that the history of the image of Edessa represents very murky territory. It cannot be traced back as a miraculous image, and it may not have even been a cloth. What is known is that the shroud belonged to a French fella named Geoffrey de Charny, Lord of Savoy, and he kept it in the church he built in honor of the Virgin Mary. The shroud was mentioned in a memorandum to Pope Clement the VII in 1390. The author, Bishop Pierre d'Assis, stated that it was a fake, painted around 1350, and that the artist had confessed, although shroud believers conveniently dismissed this letter as a fraud in itself. If you want to know more, the entire column is available right now at AfterDarkRadioShow.com, right there on the front page. So head up there and check that out. Only one bit of news that I want to talk about here today, because it's very sad. The death at the age of 85 of astronaut Edgar Mitchell. He's one of 12 men to have walked on the moon, and he was a big believer in the paranormal. Did a lot of radio shows, wrote a lot about it. This here from copycateffect.blogspot.com. Edgar Mitchell, 85, one of 12 men who have walked on the moon, died in Lake Worth, Florida on February 4, 2016. Mitchell was born on September 17, 1930 in Hereford, Texas. He considered his hometown Artesia, New Mexico, near Roswell. Mitchell stepped on the moon twice on February 5 and 6, 1971. So nearly, he almost lived to the anniversary of himself stepping on the moon. February 4th, he passed away. February 5th, he stepped on the moon. Mitchell spent 33 hours on the moon. The Apollo 14 mission was from January 31 through February 9, 1971. Therefore, he died during the 45th anniversary of his trip to the moon. His Apollo mission involvement was memorialized in the Hall of Fame at D. Molay International, part of the Masonic fraternity. He was a member of the Artesia Lodge, number 29 in New Mexico. After his Apollo success, Mitchell was involved in several projects, some with the Institute of Noetic Sciences involving the unexplained, paranormal, and human consciousness topics, including UFOs. Intriguingly, Mitchell was interviewed frequently about UFOs when the second X-Files movie appeared in 2008. Mitchell also told Bloomberg Business that the 1947 Roswell incident, which to some people is evidence of an extraterrestrial crash landing, was covered up. It's not just the military, he said. It is a cabal of organizations primarily for a profit motive. However, he drew the line when it came to an interview with the UK tabloid The Mirror. The newspaper claimed Mitchell said that UFOs had helped prevent nuclear war. None of those statements, he told the Huffington Post, were originated by me. In addition to Mitchell's UFO thoughts, it became known after Apollo that he had conducted ESP experiments while on the mission. He was also a believer in extraterrestrial activity and was convinced UFOs had visited the Earth. Edgar Mitchell, 85 years old, passed away on February 4th. One of just 12 people that have ever walked on the moon. If, of course, you believe that we went to the moon. In a moment, we're going to be joined by Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, authors of The Aztec UFO Incident, which is up and available at Amazon.com, a number of other websites as well, which we will be talking about in the show. And make sure, if you're listening live, you pay attention. We're going to have a special opportunity for those of you listening live, if you can get up there quick enough and want to grab an autographed copy of the book that is coming up later on here in this program. So check that out. Back in just a moment with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network, live on Sunday nights, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. Very happy today to be joined by Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. We're going to be talking their book, The Aztec UFO Incident. Scott is on the line right now. I'll be handing the phone back and forth to Scott and Suzanne. And Scott, how you doing?
We're doing great. Thanks for having us on the show. We're honored.
Now, I want to start off a little bit by talking about the incident itself. Obviously, the book is available at Amazon.com. If you want to go up there and grab it, there's a Kindle edition. There's a paperback edition. You can get all of the details in the book. But let's start with a capsule for those who have not heard of the Aztec UFO crash, the alleged crash. Tell everybody a little bit about the story itself.
We'll give them the Reader's Digest condensed version. As you know from reading the book, it gets pretty long-winded. Basically, the oil field workers were called out a little bit after 5 o'clock in the morning on March 25th, 1948, because of a brush fire near one of the oil drip tanks the company had. It was El Paso Gas back then. When they got out there, they realized that the brush fire was up on top of a mesa, not down in the canyon near the oil drip tanks. But one of the young workers said to the foreman, the brush fire is no threat, but you really need to come up. There's something else up here on this mesa. And they weren't quite sure what it was. Well, the brush fire was at the far western end of the mesa, and this object, this huge 100-foot diameter craft, was sitting there in the silty soil. And at first, the first opinion of the oil field workers is, well, my God, this is one of ours. It's become a rescue mission at this point. So they jumped up climbing on it, trying to look for a door or a hatch or windows. And long story short, it became evident pretty quick that this was not an experimental U.S. aircraft, that this was something that they had never seen before. And peering through the mirrored-type portholes, kind of like the mirrored sunglasses that were popular in the 70s, they could look through and see two bodies slumped over, which looked like a control panel. So anyway, that's kind of the opening of the story, and that's how I kind of heard it, bits and pieces, almost 30 years ago. And the book really goes into the detail of who was at the crash site that day, some of the ones we actually interviewed before they died. Two police officers were present. Later, probably, 15, 20 minutes into the breaking hours of daylight, a Baptist minister that was living in Aztec, but he had just reopened the Mancos Baptist Church right across the border in Mancos, Colorado, he ends up at the site, and thinking that there was a horrible oil well disaster, seeing all these vehicles going out Hart Canyon Road, he thought he'd step out there to see if he could help. So it's a very complex story because there were so many people involved, meaning local oil field workers, ranchers, a Baptist minister, a county commissioner, possibly a city council person for the city of Aztec. And then we kind of go through the history of the story with the people that were involved, all the way through who the scientists were, possibly the ones that worked on it after the recovery. So I think you were saying before we went on the air, you're getting your way through it, you're probably seeing already it's a rather complex story.
Yes. Now, one thing that's really interesting about it that I wanted to talk to you about is, obviously, everybody has heard of the Roswell crash, which would have been a year earlier, allegedly.
Yeah, and about 8 months, right.
If you were alive in the late 40s, early 50s, what's interesting and ironic is the Roswell story, which is the significantly more popular story in 2016. Far more people, I think, have heard of Roswell than the Aztec case, although people have heard of Aztec.
Yeah, sure.
But at the time, the Roswell story was like a one-day story. There was a newspaper article about it, and then the next day they said, oh, well, we were wrong, and it literally fell off the face of the earth for decades before being dug up again. But the Aztec story at the time had a lot more legs than Roswell did, and then at the end of the day, I guess a lot of researchers originally felt that it had been debunked. So kind of tell everybody that story.
Well, yeah, and, you know, you're absolutely correct with Roswell. I mean, it made many, many papers on the front page that the Army Air Force had recovered a flying saucer, and then the next day it was, oops, no, it was a weather balloon. And here you have Aztec. I think they learned a whole lot about Roswell. And it was 8 months later when the Aztec incident happened. 1950 was the first book that came out about Aztec. It was written by Frank Scully. It was titled Behind the Flying Saucers. And it came out, and it was a very big hit. I mean, it was, you know, best-selling list with Henry Hoyt and Company. Then it started getting debunked, sadly, because one of Scully, or two of Scully's main people, having nothing to do with Aztec per se, got in trouble over a doodle buggy deal. And, you know, being in the oil business, there's more scams than there's anything. But, and so I think a lot of the people wrote it off because of that. And then, you know, the story laid until 1986, 87. Bill Steinman's book came out, UFO Crash at Aztec. And it was a self-published book, about 1,000 copies. And yeah, the book didn't really do that well until the late 90s when the Aztec started showing up on the radar screen again. And then in 2002, Chris Evans had a book that came out, Alien... What was Chris's book? Alien Agenda. And it's about half that book is dedicated to Aztec. And so the interest, you know, started growing again after the Bill Steinman's book. But we kind of tear apart the debunkers and the skeptics in our book. I don't know how far into it you are, but everything that they were complaining about really was bogus. It was not a legitimate complaint to begin with.
When did you guys first really become interested in this? I know, obviously, you spent a lot of money and a lot of time putting together this project. What was it? Was it something that you read? Was it something that you heard that encouraged you to pursue this and put so much time and money into it?
Well, actually, I was out late 80s on a business trip out in the Farmington area. Farmington's, you know, 17, 18 miles to the west of the town of Aztec. And we were testing a big generator on a Friday night. And what I do for a living is we manufacture magnet wire that goes into the windings of electric motors, generators, transformers. And I was out there seeing a customer in my first time out there. And we were testing the integrity of the windings on this generator. And two of the guys that were running the test were from the local Navajo reservation. And they didn't know me. I didn't know them. But we're just kind of working together as guys. And the one said to the other, what are you doing this weekend? And one of them said, well, I'm probably going to go out Hard Canyon Road, look for a place to hunt. And the other guy said, well, that kind of sounds fun. Where are you going to be? Maybe I'll hook up with you. And he said, oh, by the old crash site. And my ears perked up, and I said, crash site? What crashed up here? And they kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, it's an old wives' tale, I think. I don't know. It's late 40s, early 50s. They say a flying saucer crashed out there. And immediately I thought, boy, we're way the other end of the state from Roswell. You know, Roswell's in the southeastern corridor. We're up in the northwestern corridor. So anyway, long story short, after we got done testing the generator, I invited him back to the Holiday Inn for a cold beer on a Friday night. And on a bar napkin, they drew me a map how to get to Aztec and then hopefully how to get out to the crash site because it's about 11.7 miles northeast of the town of Aztec. And that just sunk the hook. I mean, after that, I was kind of, I made the statement to a lot of people that you know, I got time on my hands, and I'll be coming out to this area every 6 weeks because they turned out to be a very good customer. And I should have this figured out in 6 months. And here we are. We're going on our 30th year.
That's right. Now, so sometimes you hear, like, I'll interview somebody, we'll do a show about Bigfoot, for example, and they'll mention that, you know, if you live in a city, you hear these stories and it's just like whatever. But if you actually go out to certain areas, I mean, in certain different countries, they will talk about Bigfoot like it's a fact. It's not some story. That it's just a way of life there.
Right.
In the Aztec area, I mean, you mentioned that these guys, they told you that it was an old wives' tale. But if you hang out around Aztec, I mean, is it sort of, does everybody know the story of this crash? Is it accepted as something that really happened? Do most people think it's just some sort of old wives' tale? Or what do you get if you're there?
I think you get a mixed bag today as you did back then. I always put it like this. About a third of the people will tell you it absolutely, positively happened. Another third will tell you, I could care less. And the other third will say, no, that's probably just a big story.
Yeah.
So it's about a third, a third, and a third. I think there's more people talking about it today than maybe 20, 25 years ago. The town has centered a lot of things. They have the Alien Bike Run, which is a mountain bike run that is very long and beautiful, by the way, if you're into mountain biking. And it actually takes you, the Alien Bike Run takes you through the entire crash site on that mesa and then down through a couple others. For about, I don't know, 14 years, maybe more, they had the Aztec UFO Symposium that was part of a fundraiser for the Aztec Library. And so, you know, the people in the town, it's all been positive stuff. It hasn't been the circus environment that I hate to say it, but Roswell kind of has that.
Roswell's definitely has that.
Yeah, and, you know, the alien balloons floating in downtown, the alien streetlights, the people in Aztec are taking a much more sober approach to it. I'm sure they love the tourism dollars because I know people are going there and stopping and asking for maps, how do you get to the crash site? And, you know, we get a lot of feedback on that. But they've been much more sober in how they handle the quote-unquote celebration of their famous UFO sighting.
Now, when you talk in the book, when you talk in the book about the crash itself, you mentioned that the cleanup operation, I believe you said, was something like 2 weeks long or something like that. It was an extended period of time, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
And very different from the stories of Roswell. The Roswell cleanup was supposed to be like, you know, it was in and out, matter of a couple of days maybe. Tell us a little bit about the stories of the retrieval.
Well, they had a lot difference with Roswell. Roswell, you know, you have two debris fields or two crash sites. You have the ranch, the old Mac Brazel site up on the ranch in Corona. And then in the plains of San Augustine was the quote-unquote second site where either the rest of the saucer landed or possibly two. Aztec was much different. It was a very large craft, 100 feet in diameter is, you know, pretty good size craft. 100 feet across, so that'd be 314 feet in diameter going around the craft. It was intact by all indications of people that we discussed and talked to and interviewed over the years. So in my opinion now, I think the government was going to be very careful and very slow of taking an intact craft off the site. And a road had to be cut. Concrete footers had to be poured. If you go to the crash site today, you can see what we call the mystery military road that was bulldozed out to have you access to the site. The concrete slab is still there. We've had, as you'll read in the book, a lot of analytical work done on that to make sure it fits within the time frame and it wasn't something that was put there in the 70s. And taking the craft apart, the only description we ever got from that, don't forget the oil field workers, you know, by the time the military got there, they were shooed away, so they didn't stick around for any length of time other than, you know, a long morning and into the early afternoon. But Frank Scully had some pretty good people in his book in 1950 that said it came apart in sections and the military was able to haul it out. And in chapter 10 in our book, we actually did a reenactment a few years back and reenacted removing the craft to make sure getting it from the crash site down to what was back then Highway 44, we could in fact get through the canyons and all the what we called pinch points to get it out. And that that was actually a week of painstaking work that we did.
Now, I may have read Frank Scully's book when I was very young, but I have no memory of it whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And once you started really investigating this story and trying to sift fact from fiction, what were some of the things that Frank Scully got right, and what were some of the things that he got wrong?
He didn't get much wrong, and keep in mind, I didn't know his book existed till years later. The city of Aztec presented it to me. They found a very, very pristine copy of the book and presented it to me for helping them with their UFO symposium. And it wasn't until, oh boy, late 90s that I knew Bill Steinman's book was dedicated entirely to the Aztec crash. The it's tough to say about Scully's. That's kind of been the benchmark that everybody uses to debate the issue. In Scully's book, he claimed to have the privilege of interviewing some of the scientists that worked on the recovery. And I can't really hit anything on the head that he got wrong. I think there was possibly more scientists involved. Then he refers to this group as Dr. G, a group of 8 or 9 scientists. And as we go forward with our research and we're following new leads as of today, I think that over the years there were more and more than the original 8 to 9 scientists. So, you know, if he had anything wrong in 1950, it was years later, there was more of a group at Wright-Patterson that were working on it.
When you were doing your investigations, we talked a little bit about Roswell, and I'm sure you're well familiar with the Roswell story. You've talked about it already.
Yeah.
So, when you were doing your investigations, did you find that there were, I guess maybe, in looking at both stories, facts from one case that over the years had been, I guess, misrepresented, or maybe something that somebody thought happened in Roswell they claimed happened in Aztec and vice versa? Does that make sense? Does it appear that over the years rumors from both kind of amalgamated into one story, or was there not a lot of that?
Not really. I mean, you know, just take some real quick ones. You know, Roswell's in the southeast, Aztec is in the northwest. Roswell, the debris field on a ranch, Aztec, an intact saucer on a mesa. Roswell, 2, 3, maybe 4 bodies, Aztec as many as 16. Completely different description, really, if you go back to the original work and research of Stanton Friedman and Charlie Berlitzer, what the bodies look like. The Aztec bodies were described as childlike, 3.5, maybe 4 feet tall. So there was a, you know, it was almost like, you know, one was from this part of the world and galaxy, and these were part of somewhere else. But I don't see any similarities with Aztec. It had to be disassembled and hauled away. I mean, the interesting thing we found with Aztec is the same people we interviewed over the years, including a gentleman we interviewed just 2 weeks ago. These stories are all very similar. Now, and I mean similar, you know, prior to our books coming out where we go in a lot of detail, the gentleman we talked about within the last 2 weeks, he knew details that aren't in any of these books that Suzanne and Frank Thayer and I decided not to put in this book. So that's where the credibility arrow starts pointing up.
The book itself opens with the foreword. Stanton Friedman writes the foreword. Yeah. And Stanton Friedman was a guy who felt that the Aztec case had been thoroughly debunked. But then, after reading the book, he essentially, the foreword is all about how I was wrong.
Well, it wasn't just our book. We've known Stan for a long time. He was kind enough to come to Aztec and speak at the Aztec UFO Symposium, and I had the absolute fortune of driving him from Albuquerque to Aztec. And it's just two of us in our rental car, and we're going up to Aztec, and he looked at me and said, "Hey, by the way, who's the guy doing all the research on Aztec?" And I said, "That would be me." He said, "I'm not real big on that case." I said, "I understand." And I appreciated his honesty. And then as he got to know Suzanne and I, and I would send him things. And matter of fact, I just sent him something today and said, "What's your thoughts on this?" I think the more he looked into the case from a different angle, instead of the old, you know, "Oh, well, Frank Scully's guy has got in trouble, so therefore the story couldn't exist." So he's probably had 14 years or longer of looking at our research. So it wasn't just, you know, this is our second book. Our first book came out in 2012. So he's had, you know, 14 plus years of looking over our documents and our interviews and people that, you know, we mentioned in the book to really evaluate what we've done.
So what are your thoughts overall on Roswell? I mean, this book is all about Aztec, but I mean, anybody who's followed the Roswell story knows that the government itself has like four stories. I mean, they've come up with a different story every few years. Even among UFO researchers, there's a million different stories. Oh, the craft went here, the craft went there, it was this, it was that. What are your thoughts on Roswell?
You know, I'm probably the worst person to ask on that because I get frustrated with people that comment about Aztec and people in the UFO field, and they've never even been there. And I'm guilty of that in Roswell. The closest I ever came to Roswell was about 60, 80 miles maybe, the town of Carrizozo. There was a slight connection between the town of Carrizozo and Roswell and Aztec. We talk about that in the book. But I've never been to Roswell. I've tried to read what I call the credible books. How many books are there on Roswell now? 300 plus, maybe 400?
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a lot. And I really appreciate the work that Stan Friedman and some other folks have done. Dennis Balthaser has certainly done some incredible research. He lives right there in Roswell. But I really can't comment. I certainly believe they had a UFO flying saucer incident in that town, but I kind of keep my feet to the grindstone here on the Aztec case.
Once the cleanup began, from your research, what can you tell us about where everything was taken, et cetera?
Well, that would be pure speculation because nobody we ever interviewed firsthand watch that. The gentleman that we mentioned in the book, George, who was out of Walker Airfield, that was formerly the Roswell base. They renamed it Walker in 48. I interviewed him at the Radisson Hotel, and he was very, very familiar with the entire case. He was more in charge of the personnel records for people working on the recovery. In other words, if you were there, you certainly wouldn't be as far as your personnel records. His job was to doctor up the personnel records for where people were in case they ever came back years later and claimed they were at recovery. He was giving me examples that, well, this person is going to be in the infirmary for the next week with a sprained ankle or appendicitis or whatever. And the whole recovery was a two-week operation, according to him. And at the end, the only hint he gave me as to where everything went was there was some flatbed trucks that he had to get back to their home at Holloman Air Force Base. And they were sitting at Los Alamos. And he said the only thing I could think of is they either parked them there as a deterrent or something or part of the craft went to Los Alamos. It's all speculation on my part, but we did have this gentleman come forward in the last couple of weeks, and he claimed in 1958 to 1960 it was in fact at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it was referred to as the craft they recovered at Aztec. So, you know, from 48 when the crash happened to 58, who knows, but this gentleman, who's checking out to be pretty credible, claims in 58 it was in fact at Wright Patton.
I don't even know if you'd have anything resembling an answer to this question, but I'll ask anyway. So if we believe that the Aztec crash occurred and that the Roswell crash occurred, we're talking two crashes in 2 years in the same state.
Possibly three.
Possibly three.
There could have been two at Roswell.
That's right, because we had the two debris fields.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world? It just seems... It's why New Mexico was it? Do you have any sort of theory as to it just seems beyond the realm of possibility you could have two alien crafts crashing in 2 years and essentially maybe three is noted in the same place?
No, I don't think it's hard to believe at all. I thought that originally. I thought these people out here, you know, what are they? They have the rights to all the UFO crashes, but let's look at Aztec and Roswell, 1948 to 1950. During World War II, the Manhattan Project was all about New Mexico. I mean, not all of it, but you know, certainly Los Alamos and Sandia National Labs. You had all your prototype fighters and bombers being tested there. The 509th at Roswell Army Airfield was the only nuke bomb group we had. White Sands Missile Range was in full swing, having moved from North Carolina, by the way, our state. It went from Topsail Beach, and once the German subs were spotted off our coast of North Carolina, they needed to get the rocket program the heck away. So you had rockets, you had specialty aircraft, the nuke bomb, the bombers that are going to haul the thing. You've got... you have so much going on. I mean, only 8% of the land in New Mexico today can be bought by residents. The rest is owned by the government or Indian reservations. And it's the fifth largest state in the United States, and only 8% can be bought and sold by people. So you had a lot going on then, and you know, Suzanne and I still go back. She's from there. I met her in during my research, and my mother-in-law and brother-in-law and nieces and nephews live out there. There's still a lot of military activity out there. Clovis Air Force Base, Holloman Air Force Base, Kirkland Air Force Base. It's still very, very active.
So essentially what you're saying is the New Mexico aspect of it would not have been coincidental. It's likely...
No, and really going out on a limb, I don't think these things just went from Beta Reticuli to Roswell, New Mexico, and ran out of gas. I mean, I'm being real sarcastic, but I think they were shot out of the air. You look at, as we discuss in the early parts of the book, the amount of UFO sightings they were having at Los Alamos leading up to March 25th, 1948. How many times in Stan's research was the 509th having UFO sightings? Today, you wouldn't want to just randomly fly over a military installation that's restricted airspace. You might do it and be greeted by a couple F-16s and be asked to land and have a long talk about it. But, you know, Los Alamos back in 47, 48, absolutely not. When we did all the research on the radar bases, they even flying over a radar base was restricted airspace. And some of those were, you know, 100 miles plus away from Los Alamos. And I am going out on a limb, but it's not too crazy to say that they were shot out of the sky.
So to recap, in the early part of the book, you talk about how there was a craft that was spotted over Los Alamos, and yep. This was a few weeks before the Aztec crash, which, as you noted, the story is that it was shot down, or at least shot, and maybe it didn't crash, but it made a controlled landing. And Roswell, the story I always heard about Roswell was the belief was it had been hit by lightning or something like that, but essentially it had been downed. Maybe it was shot down, who knows. But that is very different from the story of the Aztec case. So I guess tell everybody a little bit about the bodies. There were far more bodies found at Aztec, allegedly, than Roswell. And they were seemingly described very much the same way. Tell everybody about what was reported about the bodies.
I'm pretty weak in that area because the guys that we interviewed, you know, they were 19, 20, 22 years old back then. And they witnessed the small, as they put it, childlike bodies being brought out of the craft. Or the guys were up on the craft itself looking in the window could see, too. They apparently had a one-piece flight suit that was, you know, cloth material that was blue in color. And childlike appearance, no insignias on their uniforms, such as one would be a captain or a first officer or whatever. They thought that was unusual. They're just basically all in blue jumpsuits. And we've heard the number range from 12 to 14 to 16. I think it was depending on where they were at what time before they got taken off the Mesa to how many bodies had been brought out of the craft. But they were apparently more human like us because they later in the scientist in Scully's book, they talked about they had perfect teeth, which I think differentiates them more of a human type than maybe some other descriptions we've heard over the years. Their appearance looked like they had been exposed to either a high pressure or high heat. They seemed to have burns on their skin, not on the uniforms, but on the skin. And that's really it. I haven't really, you know, when you're interviewing somebody that's 87 years old that went through this when he was 22 as a kid, that they remember the craft, they remember what time of day it was, what the weather was like, but the bodies were the last thing before they were shooed off the Mesa.
It is kind of funny that sometimes when you hear witness reports to anything, it's not even just an alleged UFO or a Bigfoot or any other weird phenomenon, the weird things that they remember. Like, here's an alien in front of you, and you're fixated on its nice teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the rest? What do their eyes look like?
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, as an author, when you are interviewing these individuals, how do you vet them in the sense, are there some people that you interviewed that you just kind of thought, you know what, this guy is telling me a great story, but maybe it's very similar to a story I read in a book somewhere or whatever. Maybe he believes it's true, but I think that he's not telling me the truth right here. Did you get any of that? I mean, not to specifically mention any names or anything, but was there anybody that you were skeptical about?
Yeah, I mean, you do over the years. I mean, in 29 and a half years, there's some that you pursue and others that you don't. I think when you look at the amount of documents we have, and that number is growing every day, it just took a big growth here. Part of our 55,000-plus documents aren't always exactly related to the UFO crash, but they could be tax records. They could be real estate records. As a matter of fact, we have several boxes. It's supporting evidence, I should say. If somebody says, hey, I lived in Aztec back then, well, that's easy, or I owned a house back then, we go back and pull the deed records, and sure enough, they did or they didn't. I don't think anybody's ever sat us down and intentionally lied to us. We had one gentleman that was the pillar of the community of Aztec that told us it couldn't have happened, although he had heard the story over the years. He said it couldn't have happened because I owned the land right next to the crash site, and I'm out there every day as a rancher. I would have seen it. Well, that really had us concerned because this guy was, like I say, a huge pillar in the Aztec community. But when we went and pulled the land transactions, he bought the land in May. He actually bought it on May 17th, 1952, not 1948, like his memory had. And once that was brought to his attention, he said, oh, okay, well, that's good. At least we know it wasn't, you know, that I was wrong, and that 48 is still a good date then. But, you know, he was confusing when he and his wife bought some land. But I don't really think, I'm trying to think, but I don't remember anybody that ever intentionally sat us down and told us a big, you know, big, big tale.
Tell us about the Hoddle memo?
There's so many we have. The guy Hoddle, the FBI agent?
Yes.
I didn't uncover that one, actually. I don't even think that's in the book.
Yeah, that's very, very recent. This was just from a couple of years ago. I didn't know if you knew anything about it. I guess the FBI had done a big records dump or something of that nature, and among them was this memo, which was interesting, and I guess you didn't write about that, so we can skip that one. What are some of the better documents that you've uncovered over the last 30 years that suggest something happened?
Well, there's so many. They're hard to read in our book. They didn't scan in very well because the documents are getting old. But I think the most amazing one is the sting operation that the FBI, Army Counterintelligence Division, and possibly CIA, tried to do in downtown Denver, where a gentleman was selling black and white photos, and this is their words, not mine, of the Aztec flying saucer to a reporter from the Baltimore Times. And the Army, the FBI, and possibly CIA intervened to get the pictures before they went to the reporter. What's really interesting is the reporter from the Baltimore Sun-Times didn't exist. So now the question is, well, who is this guy posing as a reporter to buy black and white pictures, which ended up being a sting operation? And at the end of the sting, he whipped out his ID and said, hey, leave me out of this. I'm just a reporter for the Baltimore Sun-Times, just doing my job, and they let him go.
So, hold on, let me get this straight. So they were concerned that a guy was selling photos of what they said was the Aztec UFO crash.
Right in their report, their words, Aztec flying saucer.
And they wanted to confiscate them.
That's correct.
Okay, so this is very interesting.
This is right from the FBI themselves. Matter of fact, you can probably go on their reading room. Yeah, you could read the documents in our book, but you know, I got to read with reading glasses. They're a little fuzzy, just because again they're so old. They're old, the old typeset typewriter. But yes, there's two guys at the Edelweiss Bar in downtown Denver, and the one is the seller, and the buyer is a reporter from the Baltimore Sun-Times. And for $2,500, he's going to buy these black and white pictures of the flying saucer, the Aztec flying saucer. It is interrupted by the powers to be. The reporter whips out his ID and says, hey, keep me out of this. I'm just a reporter trying to do my job. They apparently let him go. The other gentleman denied the whole thing and said, oh, I was drunk and I don't have any photos. It was all a hoax. But in the FBI report, they put that they don't believe him, that he was drunk and it was just a hoax. They believe he actually had the pictures.
Well, I guess what's amazing about the whole thing is, even if when the FBI said these are photos of the Aztec UFO crash, even if they meant to put that in quotation marks, like, you know, this is the claim, we don't believe it, whatever, why would you need to confiscate them?
Exactly. Well, here it gets even better. So years later, I decide to find this reporter, dead, alive, retired, whatever. So I contact Joe Burris, who I mentioned in the book, and Joe Burris is a really good investigative reporter for the Baltimore Sun-Times, unless he's retired in the last 2 years. And he puts me in touch with the editor at the time, who was retired and living in Virginia, and right outside of D.C., and the HR person, and we go through, and they never had a reporter by that name working at the Baltimore Sun-Times. So here you have a sting on a sting, because whoever this guy was that said to the FBI and the Army CID that, hey, keep me out of this, I'm just a reporter doing my job, I talked to the gentleman that would have been his boss in retirement, and he said we would have never, back in the 50s, authorized a trip to Denver from Baltimore to buy pictures of a flying saucer for $2,500. It would have just never happened. He said that request would have come to me. I would have said, no, we're not going to do it. So that, you know, the amazing story becomes another amazing story. Well, who was the guy posing as a reporter? Was he somebody else from another division of the United States government that was secretly trying to buy these photographs?
I'm reading, I went up to the FBI website, since we'd mentioned the HODL memo, and at the very bottom here, they're explaining the whole thing. They're saying it's nothing, blah, blah, blah. I just want to read this paragraph here and ask you a question. That doesn't relate to this, but it relates to all of the memos you've got. It says here, the HODL memo does not prove the existence of UFOs. It is simply a second or third hand claim that we never investigated. Some people believe the memo repeats a hoax that was circulating at that time, but the Bureau's files have no information to verify that theory. Now, whoever wrote this right here, I presume is not in their 80s. It's probably a younger person.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're dealing with, I mean, I'm sure you've got correspondence with various people from various government organizations that have contacted you here and there, and maybe they've said something like, you know, there's nothing to this story, we know nothing about it. It would seem to me that there's a lot of people working in the government and the FBI right now who may honestly believe that there's nothing about UFOs that they could report, there's nothing in any of the files, but they don't know anything about it, because I don't know who would be in charge of this sort of thing. I'd presume that in military terms, it would be on a need-to-know basis. There'd be a very limited number of people. But what kind of roadblocks do you run into when trying to find out, is this thing genuine here? Because the people that you should ask may not really know.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, Los Alamos is a very good customer of mine. Matter of fact, my wife and I may be out there in the next six or eight weeks to go see them. And I have a very, very low clearance because I'm there to check on, you know, wire projects, basically, you know, make sure we're on the list to get a bid for it. But over the years of working on low-level projects, one building doesn't know what the other building's doing out there. And I don't think people understand. If you go on a map and you look at these places like Sandia, where I've been, and Los Alamos, it's not unusual to say, well, what do they do next door in that building? Let's see, I don't know. It's all very compartmentalized. So because somebody works for the FBI or even the CIA, that doesn't mean they have access to all the files. It's on a need-to-know basis.
In doing your research, as we run low on time here, I do want to ask this question. In doing your research, I'm sure that you have probably heard a lot of rumors. Are there other alleged UFO crash sites that people have mentioned to you? And obviously, because Aztec is your main area of focus, it's sort of like, okay, that's neat, but I can't really get into that because I'm busy on this one here. Are there other crash sites that have been rumored that either maybe people have heard about, or maybe some that a lot of people haven't heard about that maybe you're saving for a later date?
None that I could say, oh, my God, boy, as soon as we're done with Aztec, we're going to jump on that bandwagon. There's already some people looking into one that I find of interest. But I think right now, every time something happens, like we're on a radio show with you or a book comes out, we start getting a lot of leads. And some are a friend of a friend of my uncle's brother, and that's a very tough lead to follow.
Sure.
Or one is, I'm 86 years old, and I'd really like to talk to you and Suzanne and Frank Thayer because I worked at Wright-Patterson as a contractor. That gets my attention. I'm a friend of a friend of my uncle's brother. Those are very, very hard, and they don't usually end up very tall in our pile. Of course, we listen to them. They're all important. But, yeah, some of the other ones that are rumored that we've heard about here in the last year or less, there's already some pretty competent people looking into them.
Now, I wrote a book many years ago, and, of course, as soon as it's published, there's new information.
Oh, that happens all the time. Drives you nuts, doesn't it?
Yes, and you've got this book came out, I guess, just a couple of years ago, 2000?
No,
it just came out. December 2015. I'm sorry. Yeah. You mentioned the other book that you done a couple of years ago. So, this one.
Our first book called The Aztec Incident came out in 2012. That book's out of print and getting very hard to find.
That's right. So this one came out in December of 2015. So this one's very new.
Almost 6 weeks ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been 6 weeks, and I'm sure you must have gotten something new. Are you planning on having this be a book that is going to be updated at some point? I'm certainly not saying the book is out of date, because it's not. It just came out. I'm just saying, as an author, I know how these things work. I mean, is that sort of the idea that down the road, if you get more people coming forward, because sometimes when people read a book, then they come forward. And I'm sure you're going to get some of that as well.
That happened in the first book, and it's happened because our first book was self-published. It never really showed up on the radar scope. Now that Career Press and New Page Books have this book with all their marketing power behind them, Warwick, the people that you worked with, and the fact that it's available at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, and a lot of independent bookstores are carrying it. And I wanted to plug one other thing. We do have a website called www.theaztecincident.com. And if you buy a book off our website, we'll be happy to sign it for you. Our book's been out, let's call it 6 weeks. And, yes, we've had three extremely interesting leads. And that's going to take us many, many months to follow and to confirm or deny that this is good information.
The website you mentioned is theaztecincident.com. And as noted, you can buy the book there. And get a signed copy if you buy it through the website. I mentioned it's on Amazon.com, but if you want a signed copy, you can buy it through theaztecincident.com. And also, if you go up there, you can see some of the recovery site photos. There's a shot of the road to the recovery site, a plaque that is up there at the recovery site, and more. So that website is aztecincident.com. And if you want, for example, the Kindle version, you can grab that at Amazon.com. There is also an MP3 CD, which it says you can grab, the paperback as well. And I want to give you an opportunity to plug anything else you want to get out there. Any other thoughts on the book, the website, any other social media? The floor is yours.
Well, I've got an offer for your listeners. Suzanne and I have some Aztec, it's called Aztec 1941. It's a one-hour documentary. I'm sorry, Aztec 1948. I had a long day, and I got stuck in traffic getting to this interview.
Oh, man.
If for the first person from your show that buys a book, we will throw in, for free, an hour-long documentary called Aztec 1948, where they can learn more about it.
And that's through the website?
All they have to do in the comments section is put that they heard it on the After Dark radio show, and we'll gladly send them a book and the free DVD. If there's a tie, we'll send two people out one.
Okay. All right, so that's aztecincident.com. If you buy through the website and in the comment area, mention that you heard this interview, Scott and Suzanne Ramsey on the After Dark radio show, you will get a free Aztec 1948 documentary to go along with the signed book.
Yep. And the book is selling very well, better than our expectations. I don't know what we expected, but we never expected it to sell this well. And so we're very happy. Both Dr. Thayer and Suzanne and I were very happy. You want to say hi to her since she took the afternoon off to talk to you?
Absolutely. Bring her on.
Here she is. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Not too bad. We should ask you some questions since you took the whole afternoon off for this interview.
No problem.
What, I guess tell us a little bit about the whole experience of spending all this time on this. You mentioned that you were from the area. Is that right?
I did live there at the time. Not at the time of the crash, but I lived there for years, yeah.
And did you hear stories of this when you were younger growing up?
Actually, I was originally from Chicago, and then we moved to South Dakota, and I grew up in South Dakota. And I remember as a child, my mother reading a book that was, it was a used book from the 50s. I was born in the 60s, but it was in the 60s. But she was reading a used book, and it was Frank Scully's UFO Behind the Flying Saucers, I'm sorry. And she was reading it, and she talked about it, and it was so interesting to her. Well, you know, there's a lot of other things that go on in life, but that for some reason stood out in my mind. Well, years later, when they decided to move to a warmer climate, they looked into Aztec because they felt like, gosh, at least we know something about Aztec, and she was always so interested in it. Well, upon moving to Aztec, she was so disappointed because no one talked about it at all. She was just, her heart was just broken. But I had a radio show in Aztec years later. I owned a business in Aztec, or actually in Farmington, and which is adjacent to Aztec. And I had the opportunity to visit with different people. And some people flaked it off. There was a very, very good cover-up and conspiracy to do that, and we're able to document that in the book. So many people use that word, or those words, conspiracy or cover-up, and I think they get overused and the meaning becomes diluted. But in this case, we're able to actually document how that went about, which I think is very unique about the case. But over the years, I would talk to people from time to time, you know, a lot of other things going on in life, and I would get different responses. After Scott and I got together, and he was on my radio show, and we had gotten married, we went back to visit, and I called a journalist friend of mine who had won all types of awards and was a mature age woman. She and I had done some projects together in the media many years ago, and I asked her about it. I thought, son of a gun, I bet she knows something about it. I never had asked her about it, but I bet she knows something about it. She's the age that she would have had that opportunity. I called her. She was very quiet, and she went from very friendly to very tense, and she said, Suzanne, I don't ever want to talk about it. And she said, no good can come from this.
Wow.
And I said, you have to have information. And she said, did you hear what I said? No good can come from this. And I said, she says, I really advise you just to walk away from it. And I said, well, I appreciate your thoughts, and I respect you for that, but would you be willing just to give me any of your information? And she was, I don't even have anything like that anymore. So see, right there, by saying I don't even have anything like that anymore means that she did have some at some time. So that was a very interesting case. This whole situation, this whole incident, is so fascinating to me because both Scott and I come from families that really value history and accurate depiction of history. And, as you probably are aware, you find oftentimes in history that there's a different spin put on things than is the truth. And so we feel really committed to documenting and accurately documenting every single thing that we say. And I, in listening to Scott before I came on, I heard him on several cases say, this is my opinion. And that's very clear. If we have something that's our opinion, we state it. Otherwise, we can document every single thing that we say. And I love this, and I'm sorry, you get me so excited because I love talking about it, but that it's the book, too, we're able to cover the entire incident. We have sightings and documentation pre crash or landing, the crash or landing, the witnesses, how they took it apart, some of the things that they found on the craft, to the scientists that worked on the craft, to the cover-up and conspiracy. So it's a real full cycle event, not just a sighting or not just physical evidence or, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Let me go back to your journalist friend here for a second. So, you don't have to give the exact year, but I mean, approximately how long ago was this that you first asked her about this Aztec deal?
How long ago did I ask her about that, do you think? Probably around 2001.
Okay, 2001. So, her words were, no good can come from this. And here you are, you're full of joy talking about this. It sounds like a lot of good came from it. So, yeah. I guess my question is, did you ever have experiences that would have been construed by her as very bad? I mean, did you have people coming to you and saying, listen, don't talk about this. It's not going to be good for you and your family. Were you threatened? Was there anything?
Never.
Nothing resembling what Never. She was suggesting?
Never. But I will say this. I sat back and kind of analyzed why that would be. You know, I had known her for quite
I have a theory, too. That's why I asked. So go ahead.
What's that?
I have a theory, too. That's why I asked. So go ahead.
Okay. Do you want to go ahead?
No, you go first.
My theory is, due to her age and the time when she was possibly doing some investigative journalism on this, we were still in the United States. There were wars. There were a lot of, it was an interesting time in history and a lot of fear. And even when the actual incident happened, there was, I think for safety reasons, there was a lot of information that was hidden and covered up because, you know, they wanted to get a jump on the Cold War. They wanted to get a jump on technology over and above any other country. And so, in fairness, I think they probably went to cover up. And so there might have been threats, or she was old enough that she was able to talk to the people right after they had been threatened not to share any information. We live in a very different world today. Although New Mexico is still pretty rough, and sparsely populated and just as beautiful and as magnificent as it was. But the world today is very different. And I think when I look back, and this is just a quick sidebar comparison, at the crash site, this will tell you how different the world was. At the crash site, when the military helicopter came in, the people that were the witnesses were so shocked to see the helicopter. It had just been introduced to the public that they didn't know which was more interesting to them, the saucer or the helicopter. Well, surely today the saucer would be, because we see helicopters all the time. So my thoughts were that and due to who her husband was and things, that he probably got some heat for her poking around, and they didn't need to bring it out. So that was the Shaggy Dog story of it. But what's your theory?
Essentially the same. I mean, right now we're on the Dark Matter Digital Network, which was Art Bell's network when he was coming back. And in the late 80s and early 90s, when he started doing this, it was totally revolutionary. And
right.
Once the internet took off, and now you've got 9 million paranormal podcasts, you've got all of these things on YouTube, you've got a million websites. I mean, nowadays, I don't want to say that I don't think the government cares, but I think they care a lot less because, quite frankly, there's a lot of crazy people out there.
Yep.
And I think there's kind of an assumption that if somebody's saying something on the internet, they're probably crazy, and other people think they're crazy, so why even bother dealing with it? It's more mainstream, but I think it's taken less seriously in a lot of ways now because there's so much of it everywhere.
Diluted. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I often think to myself, when you do have, and I'll use your words, crazy people, when you do have people come out and make claims that they can't prove or make false claims strictly for money, and we certainly, since we've been researching this, have come in contact with people like that, it breaks my heart because there are people that have really had positive and negative experiences and actually had true life experiences, and that all gets diluted and they get disregarded because of some fool that goes out and trashes it up.
You mentioned you did a radio show. What was that about?
It was a news talk radio show, and I talked to people from all walks of life, from all over the world. Any topic, anything from politics. I did UFOs. I did.
That was my question. Did you ever throw it out there? Anybody know anything about Aztec?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Did you throw that out there, asking if anybody knew anything about Aztec?
Only when I would have, you know, I would have Scott, or I would have Stanton, or Carl Flock, or Dennis Balthaser, or, oh my gosh, yeah, John Greenwald's been on, you know, just people that I got to know as friends. But, you know, I never threw it out otherwise, but I, from time to time, I would have people, when they would see me in public, I was very active in the area, and And people would see me in public, and they'd come by, and they'd go, "Heard your show." And they'd just smile and wink, and that was it. And, you know, I didn't really push people because I found some of them had some really interesting experiences based on that. And they've had some positive, as I said, negative things happen since that incident. And this last year, though, I will tell you that we were able to go out, and it was the first time in all these years we've wanted to do it. We knew it existed, but we couldn't track it down, and it was really a very exciting thing. One of the witnesses after the craft left Cuba, New Mexico, and a police officer followed it up about 100 miles into the night, and it was fluttering and struggling, and it got to Bloomfield, New Mexico, which is just a few miles away from Aztec, and it flew over a ranch of a gentleman that was a Bataan Death March survivor. And so a very credible man. I mean, good God, he'd been through what in his life? And so I sometimes laugh and think this had to be nothing compared to the Bataan Death March. But anyway, and he was walking out to his goat pen about 5 o'clock in the morning, and he heard a sonic boom, what he said sounded like a sonic boom, and he looked up and saw the craft, and it hit and scraped into a cliff and created sparks, and then it continued on where it ended up landing eventually. And talking to those family members and able to actually climb and hike 120 feet bluff and cliff to get to where it scraped, and we were able to find it, was fascinating to be able to get that family. That was a family that we had wanted to visit with for years. I mean, how critical is that experience that he had it? And finally, this last year, just before we went to print with the book, we were able to get that information in. So there's people out there. It's just, you know, some of them just don't really like to talk about it, or they're uncomfortable, or they're still fearful.
Are there any other names that, and obviously you don't have to mention them here, but you know they have stuff that they could tell you, and they've been holding off, and you're hoping that before all is said and done, they'll decide to come forward and tell you what they know?
I feel like some of them I wish they were still alive. That's one of those things, if you could have dinner with anybody, who would they be? Oh, my gosh, I could just go crazy. You know, it's like, oh. I wouldn't even eat dinner. I'd be so excited. But I don't know if right off the top of my head, anybody that's alive that we particularly know names that we wish they'd come forward. Maybe two or three families. We might be able to get something yet. But we do feel that there are people out there that have information. Some of them we just are still trying to track down.
Now, you mentioned that on your radio show, you talked about all subjects and mentioned UFOs. Were you interested in the paranormal aside from the Aztec case? Or was that just sort of something that, who cares about everything else? But that story has stuck with me my whole life.
Since I've been a child, I grew up in a family that was very interested in knowledge and seeking knowledge. I mean, our house was full of books, far more than most people's would be. I mean, I recently went to my parents' house and sold at one point 300 and another, not sold, but gave away 3 and then another 500, and there's still lots. So that gives you an idea of how important books were and learning. And my parents were very open-minded into a lot of things. I can't say specifically UFOs, although that was a consideration. I never doubted it my whole life. I've never doubted it. But I personally have never had an experience. But I come from the thought that just because I haven't experienced something doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. So I guess that answers your question, does it?
Yeah. I guess any other notes you'd like to get in before we wrap it up here today? We're plugging the opportunity for anybody listening. I presume it's already been claimed, but if it is not, the offer is out there. If you grab the book from the AztecIncident.com, and in the comments section, mention that you heard about it on this show, After Dark Radio. You will get a free copy of the Aztec 1948 documentary. I guess I should ask if somebody listening right now, maybe they just tuned in and they missed out, how else can they grab the documentary?
You can order it. Amazon does have it. You can order the book or the documentary on Amazon. The book you can get at Barnes & Noble. And any further places that you can get it. If you want to watch our Facebook page, we not only have pictures of the crashed area and information about it additionally that we didn't put in the book, it kind of gives you a better feel of it. I'm trying to think. I think that's about it. The only place that they can get the video, isn't it? Is
UFO TV.
Oh, UFO TV, too.
UFOTV.com?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I should have said that.
All righty. Got that down there. So if anybody wants a documentary and you did not get a chance, you can grab it at UFOTV.com. So you can check that out as well. Any other big projects you guys are working on now that this one's in the books, so to speak?
Brian, 29 and a half years. Come on. We're not even done with this one. Actually, there are a couple things that we've considered about looking into. But, you know, every time that we think, well, we're going to take a break from this, we get sucked back in because we get another lead and then we need to follow it. We've been married, we're pushing 13 years. And all but a couple of days on our honeymoon, we have worked on this every single day. And so most people are not as insane as we are to do something like this. I mean, it's our own money. We've spent over $500,000 over the years. And then you have to have storage places for all the papers. You know,
that's right.
Most people just are not caught up in it like we are. But we feel like if we're going to do it, you just can't leave any stone unturned.
Well, as noted, 30 years, $500,000. If you want the definitive look at the Aztec UFO Incident, that is the name of the book, The Aztec UFO Incident. It is available at Amazon.com. You can grab the Kindle edition, the paperback edition. There is an MP3 CD you can grab. You can also head to the website, which is TheAztecIncident.com. And inside, you can grab a copy of the book, which will be autographed if you buy it through the website. And if you are the first or second person, I believe Scott said, to add in the subject area that you heard about it on this show, you'll also get a free copy of Aztec 1948 documentary. That one is also available at UFO.TV.com or UFOTV.com or on the Amazon.com as well. So I think I got everything there. And
my goodness.
Yeah, I try. And Suzanne, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and Scott as well. Best of luck with the book. As noted, it just came out, and I hope it goes great for you guys, and hopefully we can talk about it again someday.
Oh, thank you so much. What a pleasure. We really enjoyed it.
And, of course, thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here for the final segment of the show. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Digital Network, every Sunday, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. If you missed any portion of this show, the interview with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, you can always head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com for the download, which is up for about a week after we finish up every show. Tonight, of course, it is a doubleheader as always. We will be followed by Dragon King Dark with Carl Stern, which is also available exclusively at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you missed that show or you want to hear a replay, that will also be available at AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Our website's got it all. We've got shows. We have got columns. Mark House's columns are up there every week. There's a new one up there, as noted earlier, about the Shroud of Turin. And, of course, if you scroll down the left-hand side of the page, there's all of the contact information there if you want to get a hold of me or Carl. My address, Brian@AfterDarkRadioShow.com. Carl is Carl at Dragon King Carl. You can also get information on how to contact Kenneth Nita, who is our producer, as well as our other producer, Andrew Ludsky, who is the man behind the Facebook page, facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow. You can message him through the Facebook page if you have guest requests, Or if you would like to be a guest here on the program, give them all the information and we'll see if we can set that up. AfterDarkRadioShow.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Brian Alvarez. Fun Twitter to follow, especially if you are a wrestling fan, since that is my main job. Everything you ever wanted to know about pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, follow me at Brian Alvarez. And also get information on how to hear the wrestling radio show live and free every single day on Sports Byline USA. So as always, I want to thank all of you for listening here today. Keith Rowland, the man behind the Dark Matter Digital Network, very much want to thank him for all of the work that he does. We'll be back next week with a brand new show, and do not touch that internet dial. Carl Stern's Dragon King Dark coming up right after the break, and we will talk to you again next time. After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.
Down the river came a sweet